No, not the appeal. I'm persuaded by them. It's not an emotional spasm. It's entirely a matter of rational. Anything emotional has to be a spasm, is it? The way you're behaving... No! You're not listening to me, Lyra. I don't think we've got anything in common anymore. I just can't stand watching you turn into this rancorous, reductive monster of cold logic. You're changing. That's the point. I don't like it. Damn it, we used to warn each other about this sort of... And you think it's all the fault of one novel? No, it's the fault of that Talbot man too. He's just as bad, in a cowardly sort of way. Talbot? Simon Talbot, make your bloody mind up, Pan. There couldn't be two more different thinkers. Complete opposites. According to Talbot, there's no truth at all. Brander, you didn't see that chapter in The Constant Deceiver? What chapter? The one I had to suffer you reading through last week. Evidently you didn't take it in, though I had to. The one where he pretends that demons are merely, what is it? Psychological projections with no independent reality. That one. Oh, all argued very prettily, charming, elegant prose, witty, full of brilliant paradoxes. You know the one I mean. But you haven't got any independent reality. You know that. If I died, neither of you, you stupid cow! If I died, so would you! Touché! She turned away, too angry to speak. Simon Talbot was an Oxford philosopher whose latest book was much discussed in the university. Whereas The Hypercharasmians was a popular success that was dismissed as tosh by critics and read mainly by the young, The Constant Deceiver was a favourite among literary experts, who had praised its elegance of style and playful wit. Talbot was a radical sceptic, to whom truth and even reality were rainbow-like epiphenomena with no ultimate meaning. In the silvery charm of his prose, everything solid flowed and ran, broke apart like mercury spilled from a barometer. "No," said Pan, "they're not different. Two sides of the same coin. Well, just because of what they say about demons, or don't say, they don't pay you enough tribute. Lyra, I wish you could hear yourself. Something's happened to you. You're under a spell or something. These men are dangerous." "Superstition," she said, and she truly felt contempt for Pan just then, and hated herself for it, and couldn't stop. "You can't look at anything calmly and dispassionately. You have to throw insults at it. It's childish, Pan, attributing some kind of evil or magic to an argument you can't counter. You used to believe in seeing things clearly, and now you're all bound up in fog and superstition and magic. Afraid of something because you can't understand it." "Oh, I understand it perfectly. The trouble is that you don't. You think those two charlatans are profound philosophers. You're hypnotized by them. You read the absolute drivel they write, both of them, and you think it's the latest thing in intellectual achievement. They're lying, Lyra. Both lying. Talbot thinks he can make truth disappear by waving his paradoxes around. Brander thinks he can do it just by bullheaded denial. You know what I think's at the bottom of this infatuation of yours? Oh, there you go again, describing something that doesn't exist. But go on, say what you want to. It's not just a position you're taking up. You half believe those people, that German philosopher and the other man. That's what it is. You're clever enough on top, but underneath you're so bloody naive that you half believe their lies are true." She shook her head, spread her hands, baffled. "I don't know what I can say," she said. "But what I believe, or half believe, or don't believe, isn't really anyone else's business. Making windows into people's souls, but I'm not anyone else. I am you." He twisted around and sprang up onto the bookcase again, from which he looked down at her with blazing eyes. "You're making yourself forget," he said, with bitter anger. "Well, now, I don't know what you mean," she said, genuinely lost. "You're forgetting everything important, and you're trying to believe things that'll kill us." "No," she said, trying to keep her voice steady. "You've got it wrong, Pan. I'm simply interested in other ways of thinking. It's what you do when you study, one of the things you do. You see ideas, try to see ideas, with someone else's eyes. You see what it feels like to believe the things they do. It's contemptible. What is? Philosophy? If philosophy says I don't exist, then yes, philosophy is contemptible. I do exist. All of us, we demons, and other things too. Other entities, your philosophers would say, we exist. Trying to believe nonsense will kill us. You see, if you call it nonsense, you're not even beginning to engage with it intellectually. You've already surrendered. You've given up trying to argue rationally. You might as well throw stones.
Pan turned away. They said nothing more as they went to breakfast. This was going to be another silent day. There had been something he'd wanted to tell her about that little notebook from the rucksack, the one with the names and addresses. But now he'd keep that to himself. After breakfast, Lyra surveyed the pile of clothes that needed washing, and sighed heavily, and began to do something about it. St. Sophia's had a laundry room full of machines where the young ladies could wash their own clothes, an activity felt to be better for their characters than having them washed by servants, which was the way of things for the young gentlemen of Jordan. She was alone in the laundry room, because most of her friends were going home for Christmas, so would be taking their clothes back with them for washing. Lyra's status as an orphan, whose only home was a men's college, had aroused the sympathy of several friends in the past, and she'd spent various Christmases in the houses of different girls, interested to see what a family home was like, being made welcome, and giving and receiving presents, and being included in all the family games and outings. Sometimes there was a brother to flirt with. Sometimes she had felt alienated from the close and over-emphatic jollity. Sometimes she had to put up with a lot of intrusive questioning about her unusual background. And always she came back to the calm and quiet of Jordan College, where only a few scholars and the servants remained with pleasure. That was her home. The scholars were friendly enough, but remote and preoccupied with their studies. The servants paid attention to important and immediate things like food or manners, or little jobs by which she could earn a bit of pocket money, such as polishing the silver. One of the Jordan College servants, whose relationship with Lyra had changed over the years, was Mrs. Lonsdale. She was called housekeeper, which wasn't a position that existed in most colleges. But part of her duties had included making sure that the child Lyra was clean and neatly dressed, that she knew how to say please and thank you and so on. And no other college had a Lyra. Now that her charge could dress herself and had learned enough manners to get by, Mrs. Lonsdale had mellowed a good deal. She was a widow. She had been widowed very young and had no children. And she had become so much a part of the college that it was impossible to imagine the place without her. No one had ever tried to define her role exactly or list all her responsibilities, and it would have been impossible to try that now. Even the energetic new bursar, after one or two attempts, had had to retreat graciously and acknowledge her power and importance. But she never acquired power for its own sake. The bursar knew, as did all the servants, as did all the scholars and the master, that Mrs. Lonsdale's considerable influence was always used to strengthen the college and to look after Lyra. And by the time she was entering her 20th year, Lyra herself had begun to realize that too. So she had fallen into the habit of visiting Mrs. Lonsdale in her parlour from time to time, gossiping or asking for advice, or taking her little presents. The woman's tongue was no less caustic than it had been in Lyra's childhood, and of course there were things that Lyra could never have told her, but as far as it was possible, the two of them had become friends. And Lyra noticed with Mrs. Lonsdale, as she'd done with other people who had seemed grand and all-powerful and ageless when she was young, that the housekeeper wasn't that old at all, really. She could easily have children of her own still. But that, of course, was a conversation they would never have. After she'd lugged her clean clothes back to Jordan and made a second trip to carry all the books she'd need for the vacation, she went to the market and spent some of her silver polishing money on a box of chocolates, and called on Mrs. Lonsdale at a time when she knew the housekeeper would be taking tea in her parlour.
"Hello, Mrs. Lonsdale," she said,
kissing the housekeeper's cheek.
"What's the matter with you, then?"
said Mrs. Lonsdale.
"Nothing." "Don't try fooling me. Something's up. That Dick Orchard giving you the runaround."
"Oh, no, I finished with Dick," Lyra said, sitting down. "Good-looking boy, though."
"Yes," said Lyra. "I can't deny that. But we just ran out of things to say." "Yes, that does happen. Put the kettle on, dear."
Lyra moved the old black kettle from the hearthstone to the little iron stand over the fire while Mrs. Lonsdale opened her box of chocolates.
"Oh, lovely," she said. "Maidment's truffles. I'm surprised they had any left after supplying the founder's feast. Now, what you been up to? Tell me all about your rich and glamorous friends."
"Not so rich now, some of them," Lyra said, and told her about Miriam's father's trouble, and how she'd had another view of the same matter from Mr. Corson the day before.
"Rosewater," said Mrs. Lonsdale. "My granny used to make that. She had a big copper pan, and she'd fill it with rose petals and spring water and boil it and distill the steam, whatever the word is, run it through a lot of glass pipes and let it turn into water again, and there you are. She made lavender water as well. Seemed a lot of bother to me when you could buy Eau de Cologne at Boswell's cheap enough."
"Mr. Corson gave me a little bottle of his special rose water, and it was, oh, I don't know, so rich and concentrated.
Attar of roses, that's what they call it. Or maybe that's something different."
"Mr. Corson didn't know why it was so hard to get hold of now. He said Dr. Polstead would know."
"Why don't you ask him, then?"
"Well..." Lyra made a face.
"Well, what?"
"I don't think Dr. Polstead finds me very easy."
"Why not?"
"'Cause when he tried to teach me a few years ago, I was rude to him, probably."
"What do you mean, probably?"
"I mean, we just didn't get on.
You gotta like your teachers, I think. Or if not like them, then feel something in common with them. I've got nothing in common with him at all. I just feel awkward near him. And I think he feels the same."
Mrs. Lonsdale poured the tea. They gossiped for a while longer about intrigues in the college kitchen, involving a feud between the head chef and the pastry chef, about Mrs. Lonsdale's recent purchase of a winter coat, and Lyra's own need for a new one, about Lyra's other friends at St. Sophia's, and their adoration of the handsome pianist who just played in the city. Once or twice, Lyra thought of telling her about the murder, the wallet, the rucksack, but held back. There was no one who could help her with it but Pan, and it felt as if they wouldn't be speaking much about anything for some time to come. Every so often, Mrs. Lonsdale glanced at Pantalaimon, who was lying on the floor pretending to sleep. Lyra could tell what she was thinking. "What's this coldness about? Why aren't you two speaking?" But that wasn't something they could easily talk about in Pan's hearing, and that was a pity, because Lyra knew that the housekeeper would bring some sharp good sense to bear on the subject. They chatted for an hour or so, and Lyra was about to say goodbye and leave when there was a knock on the parlour door. It opened without waiting for an invitation to come in, which surprised Lyra. And then she was even more surprised, because the visitor was Dr. Polstead. Several things happened at once. Pan sat up as if he'd been shocked, and leaped onto Lyra's lap, and she automatically put her arms around him. Dr. Polstead realized that there was a visitor, and said,
"Oh, Lyra, I do beg your pardon,"
which suggested to Lyra that he was in the habit of entering this room, that the housekeeper was a close friend, that he expected to find her alone. Then he said to Mrs. Lonsdale,
"Alice, I'm sorry, I'll come back later."
And she said to him,
"Don't be silly, Mal. Sit down."
Their demons, hers a dog, his a cat, were touching noses with great familiarity and friendliness. Pan was watching them fiercely, and Lyra felt an almost ambaric charge in the fur under her hands.
No, said Dr. Polstead. It can wait. I'll see you later.
Lyra's presence embarrassed him. That was clear. And his demon was now gazing at Pan with a strange intensity. Pan was trembling on Lyra's lap. Dr. Polstead turned and left, his big frame almost too large for the doorway. His demon followed. When the door closed, Lyra felt the Anbaric charge leave Pan's fur, like water draining out of a basin.
"Pan, what is going on?" she said. "What's the matter with you?"
"Tell you later," he muttered.
"And Alice? Mal?"
Lyra said, turning to Mrs. Lonsdale.
"What's all that, then?"
"Never you mind."
Lyra had never seen Mrs. Lonsdale embarrassed before. She'd have sworn it wasn't possible. The housekeeper was even blushing as she turned away and attended to the fire.
"I didn't even know your name was Alice," Lyra went on.
"I'd have told you if you'd asked."
"And Mal?"
"I didn't see him as a Mal. I knew his initial was M, but I thought it was Methuselah."
Mrs. Lonsdale had regained her composure. She sat back in her chair and folded her hands in her lap.
"Malcolm Polstead," she said, "is the bravest and the best man you'll ever know, girl. If it wasn't for him, you wouldn't be here now."
"What do you mean?" Lyra was baffled.
"I told him often enough we ought to tell you about it, but the time was never right."
"About what? What are you talking about?"
"Something that happened when you were very young."
"Well, what?"
"Let me talk to him first."
Lyra scowled.
"If it's something about me, I ought to be told," she said.
"I know. I agree.
So why? Leave it to me, and I'll talk to him." "And how long will that take? Another 20 years?
The old Mrs. Lonsdale would have said, "Don't take that tone with me, child," and accompanied her words with a slap. The new one, this Alice person, just shook her head gently.
"No," she said, "I could tell you the whole story, but I shan't till he agrees."
"It's obviously something he feels awkward about. Not as awkward as I do, though. People shouldn't keep secrets about other people from them." "It's nothing to anyone's discredit. Get off your high horse."
Lyra stayed a little longer, but the friendly mood had passed. She kissed the housekeeper goodbye and left. As she crossed the dark quadrangle of Jordan, Lyra thought of going across the road to Durham College and confronting Dr. Polstead directly. But the thought had no more than entered her mind when she felt Pan tremble on her shoulder.
"Right," she said. "You're going to bloody well tell me what's the matter, and you've got no choice about it.
Let's get inside first."
"Why?" "You don't know who might be listening."
The college bell tolled 6 as she shut the door of her old sitting room behind them. She dropped Pan on the carpet and sat down in the sagging armchair, switching on the table lamp to make the room spring warmly into life around them.
"Well," she said,
"the other night when I was out, didn't you feel anything? Didn't you wake up?" She thought back.
"Yes, I did. Just for a moment. I thought it was when you saw the murder."
"No, I know it wasn't then, because I would have felt you waking. It was after that, when I was coming back to St. Sophia's with the man's wallet. It was... Well, someone saw me."
Lyra felt her heart become heavy all at once. She'd known this would happen. He quailed at the look on her face.
"But the thing is, it wasn't a person," he said.
"What the hell do you mean?
Who was it then?" "It was a demon. Another demon. Separated like us."
Lyra shook her head. "This made no sense at all. There isn't anyone like us except the witches," she said. "And that dead man. Was it a witch's demon?"
"No." "And where was this?" "In the parks. She was..."
"She?"
"She was Dr. Polstead's demon. The cat. I forget her name. That's why just now..."
Lyra felt breathless. She couldn't speak for a moment.
"I don't believe it," she said finally. I just don't believe it. They can separate. Well, she was on her own, and she saw me, but I wasn't sure it was her till he came into the room back there. You saw the way she looked at me. Maybe she wasn't sure it was me till then either. But how can they... People know about separation, other people. The man who was attacked when his demon got me to come to him, she told him I was separated, and he knew what it meant, and he told me to take the wallet to my... to you."
Another blow to Lyra's heart, as she realized what Dr. Polstead's demon must have seen.
"She saw you running back to St. Sophia's carrying the wallet. She must have thought you'd stolen it.
They think we're thieves.
She sank back into the chair and put her hands up to cover her eyes.
We can't help that, he said. We know we're not, and they'll have to believe us. Oh, just like that? When are we going to tell them? We'll tell Mrs. Lonsdale then. Alice, she'll believe us.
Lyra felt too tired to speak.
I know it's not a good time,
Pan said, but didn't finish.
Oh, you're not kidding. Oh, Pan.
Lyra had never felt so disappointed, and Pan saw it.
Lyra,
were you ever going to tell me?
Yes, of course, but don't bother now. Just don't say anything.
I've got to get changed. I could really, really, really do without this.
She moved listlessly into the bedroom and picked out a dress. They had a dinner with the master to get through before they'd speak again. During the vacation, or on evenings like this, dinner at Jordan College was a less formal affair than during term. Sometimes, depending on how many scholars were present, it wasn't even served in hall, but in a small dining room above the buttery. Lyra generally preferred to eat with the servants anyway. It was one of the privileges of her unique position that she could move in any of the circles that made up the complex ecology of the place. A full scholar would have felt, or be made to feel, she thought, a little ill at ease in the company of the kitchen staff or the porters. But Lyra was just as much at home with them or the gardeners or the handymen as with the higher servants like Mr. Corson or Mrs. Lonsdale, or with the master and his guests. Sometimes these guests, politicians or business people or senior civil servants or courtiers, brought with them a breadth of knowledge and a world of experience quite different from the academic specialisms of the scholars, which were deep indeed, but narrow. And not a few of these outside visitors were surprised by the presence of this young girl, so apparently confident, so eager to hear what they had to say about the world. Lyra had discovered how to listen, how to respond and encourage these people to say a little more than they meant to be indiscreet. She was surprised to find how many of these shrewd and worldly men, and women too, seemed to enjoy the sensation of giving away little secrets, little glimpses into the background of this political manoeuvre or that business merger. She did nothing with the knowledge she gained in this way, but she was aware that sometimes a scholar of the college listening nearby, perhaps an economist or a philosopher or an historian, was grateful to her for unlocking a small revelation or two that they would never have managed to open themselves. The only person who seemed uneasy about her diplomatic skill, and sometimes even about her presence, was the master of the college. The new master, as some still thought of him, and perhaps always would. The old master, who had taken a particular interest in her, and had always been firm about her right to live this strange life in the college, but not of it, or of it, but not always in it, had died a year before, very old, greatly esteemed, and even loved. The new master was Dr. Werner Hammond, not a Jordan man, or even an Oxford man, but a businessman from the world of pharmaceuticals, who had had a distinguished career as a scholar of chemistry before becoming chairman of one of the great medical corporations and enlarging its powers and revenues considerably. Now he had returned to the academic sphere, and no one could say he didn't belong there. His scholarship was impeccable, his command of 5 languages complete, his tact flawless, his conscientious immersion in the history and traditions of Jordan beyond reproach. But there were some older scholars who found him a little too good to be true, and wondered whether his mastership of the college was the real culmination of his career, or a stepping stone on the way to something even grander. The one thing he had not completely understood about Jordan College was Lyra. Dr. Hammond had never known anything like this strange young self-possessed figure, who inhabited the college as if she were a wild bird that had chosen to make her nest in a corner of the oratory roof among the gargoyles, and was now regarded with protective affection by everyone in the place. He was interested in how this had happened. He made inquiries. He consulted senior members. And the week before the end of term, he sent a note to Lyra, inviting her to dine with him in the master's lodging on the evening after the founder's feast. She was a little puzzled, but not much concerned. Of course he would want to talk to her, or listen, more likely. No doubt there were all kinds of things she could tell him that it would be useful for him to know. She was a little surprised to learn from Mr. Corson that she was to be the only guest. But he could tell her nothing about the master's intentions. Dr. Hammond received her with great friendliness. He was silver-haired and slim, with rimless spectacles and a beautifully cut grey suit. His demon was a small and elegant lynx, who sat on the hearthrug with Pantalaimon and made easy and charming conversation. The master offered Lyra sherry and asked her about her studies, about her schooling, about her life at St. Sophia's College. He was interested to hear about her private study of the alethiometer with Dame Hannah Ralph, and told Lyra of how he'd met Dame Hannah in Munich on some corporate business, and of how highly he'd esteemed her, and how she'd been instrumental in some complex negotiations that had eased the passage of an international trade deal with a dusty corner of the Near East. That didn't sound much like Hannah, thought Lyra. She must ask her. Over the meal, which was served by one of the master's private staff whom Lyra hadn't seen before, she tried to ask the master about his previous career, his background, and so on. She was really only making conversation for the sake of politeness. She'd already decided that the man was clever and courteous, but dull. She was slightly interested in whether he was single or widowed. There was no Mrs. Hammond in evidence. The old master had been a bachelor, but it wasn't a requirement that the master should be unmarried. A pleasant wife, a young family, would have added a lot to the liveliness of the place. And Dr. Hammond was presentable enough, still young enough to have those desirable additions to his household. But he avoided answering Lyra's questions with great skill, and gave not the slightest hint that he thought them intrusive. Then came dessert, and the purpose of the evening became clear. "Lyra, I've been meaning to ask you about your position here at Jordan College," the master began, and she felt the faintest little sensation, like a tremor in the ground. "It's a very unusual one," he went on, gently. Yes, she said. "I'm very lucky. My father sort of put me here, and they just, well, put up with me. You're how old now? 21? 20. Your father, Lord Asriel," he said. "That's right. He was a scholar of the college. Dr. Carne, the old master, was sort of my guardian, I suppose." "In a way," he said, "though it doesn't seem to have ever been made into a legally valid arrangement." That surprised her. Why would he have wanted to find that out? "Does that matter?" she said cautiously. "Now that he's dead?" "No. But it might have a bearing on the way things move in the future." "I'm not sure I understand." "Do you know the origin of the money you're living on?" Another little earth tremor. I knew there was some money that my father left," she said. "I don't know how much or where it's been looked after. Those were things I never questioned. I suppose I must have thought that things were all right. I mean, I thought that... Dr. Hammond, may I ask why we're talking about this?"
"Because the college, and I as the master, are, as it were, in loco parentis towards you. In an informal way, because you've never actually been in statu pupillari. It's my duty to keep an eye on your affairs until you come of age. There was a sum of money put by for your benefit, to pay for your living expenses and accommodation and so on, but it wasn't put there by your father. It was Dr. Kahn's money."
"Was it?" Lyra was feeling almost stupid, as if this was something she should have known about all her life, and it was negligent of her not to.
"So he never told you?" the master said.
"Not a word. He told me I would be looked after, and there was no need to worry. So I didn't. In a way, I thought the whole college was sort of looking after me. I felt I belonged here. I was very young. You don't question things. And it was his money all the time, not my father's.
I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe your father was living as an independent scholar, in a rather hand-to-mouth way. He vanished when you were, what, 13 years old?
12,
said Lyra. The throat had tightened. 12. Well, that would have been the point when Dr. Khan decided to put a sum of money aside for your benefit. He wasn't a rich man, but there was enough. It was looked after by the college's solicitors, who invested it prudently, paid over a regular sum to the college for your rent and living expenses, and so on. But, Lyra, I have to tell you that the interest on the capital sum was never quite adequate. It appears that Dr. Khan continued to subsidize it from his income, and the money he originally placed with the solicitor for your benefit is now exhausted. She put down her spoon. The creme caramel suddenly seemed inedible.
What? I'm sorry, but this is a shock, she said.
Of course, I understand. Pan had come up onto her lap. She moved her fingers through his fur.
So this means I have to leave, she said. You're in your second year of study?
Yes. One more year to go after this one. It's a pity that none of this was made clear to you before, Lyra, so that you would be prepared.
I suppose I should have asked.
You were young. Children take things for granted. Not your fault at all, and it would be very unjust to expose you to consequences you could never have foreseen. This is what I propose. Jordan College will fund the remainder of your education at St. Sophia's. As far as your accommodation outside term is concerned, you may of course continue to live here in Jordan, which is, after all, your only home, until you graduate. I understand you have the use of a second room, as well as a bedroom.
Yes, she said,
finding her voice quieter than she had expected. Well, this presents us with a little problem. You see, the rooms on that staircase are really needed for undergraduates. For our young men. That is what they were built for, were always intended for. The rooms you occupy could accommodate 2 first-year undergraduates who currently have to live outside college, which is not ideal. We could, at a pinch, go back to asking you to use 1 room only, which would free the second room for 1 man, but there are matters of propriety, of modesty, one might say, which make it unsuitable.
There are undergraduates living on the same staircase, Lyra said. There always have been. It's never been unsuitable before,
but not on the same landing. It would not work, Lyra.
And I'm only here in the vacation, she said, beginning to sound desperate. During term, I live at St. Sophia's.
Of course, but the presence of your belongings in that room would make it impossible for a young man to make the place properly his own. Lyra, this is what the college can offer. There is a room, a small one, I admit, above the kitchen, currently used as a storeroom. The bursar will arrange for that room to be furnished and made available to you for the duration of your studies. You may live here as you have done all your life until you graduate. Rent, meals during the vacation, we shall cover all that, but you must understand, this is how things will be in the future.
I see, she said.
May I ask, do you have any other family?
None.
Your mother?
She vanished at the same time as my father.
And there are no relations on her side?
I never heard of any. Except, I think she might have had a brother. Someone told me that once. But I don't know anything about him, and he's never been in touch with me.
Ah, I'm sorry. Lyra tried to pick up a spoonful of her dessert, but her hand was shaking. She put the spoon down. "Would you care for some coffee?" he said.
"No, thank you. I think perhaps I'd better go. Thank you for dinner."
He stood up, formal, elegant, sympathetic, in his beautiful grey suit and silver hair. His demon came to stand beside him. Lyra gathered Pan up in her arms as she stood up too.
"Would you like me to move out at once?" she said.
"By the end of the vacation, if you could manage that."
"Yes. All right. And, Lyra, one more thing. You've been used to dining in hall, to accepting the hospitality of the scholars, to coming and going freely as if you were a scholar yourself. It's been put to me by several voices, and I'm bound to say I agree, that that behaviour is no longer appropriate. You will be living among servants, and living, so to speak, as a servant. It would not be right any more for you to live on terms of social equality with the academic body. Of course not, she said. Surely she was dreaming this. I'm glad you understand. You will have things to think about. If it would help at all to talk to me, to ask any questions, please don't hesitate to do so. No, I won't. Thank you, Dr. Hammond. I'm in no doubt now about where I belong and how soon I shall have to leave. I'm only sorry to have troubled the college for so long. If Dr. Carne had been able to explain things as clearly as you can, I might have realized much sooner what a burden I was being, and that would have spared you the embarrassment of telling me. Good night.
It was her bland voice, her wide-eyed, innocent look, and she was secretly glad to see they still worked, because he had not the faintest idea how to respond. He gave a little stiff bow, and she left without another word. She walked slowly back around the main quad and stopped to look up at the little window of her bedroom, close against the square bulk of the lodge tower.
Well, she said, that was cruel. I don't know. If there's no money left, I don't know.
I didn't mean that. You know what I meant. The servant thing.
Nothing wrong with being a servant.
All right, those several voices, then. I don't believe any scholar in the college would want us treated like that. He was just deflecting the blame.
Well, you know what won't help, Pan? Complaining. That won't help.
I wasn't complaining. I was just, whatever you were doing, don't do it.
There are things to be sad about. Like the rooms. We know that little room over the kitchen. There isn't even a window in it.
But we should have woken up before now, Pan. We haven't even thought once about money, except the pocket money for polishing the silver and that sort of thing. There were bound to be costs. For meals and rooms, they cost money. Someone was paying all the time. We just didn't think about it.
They let the money run out, and they didn't tell us. They should have told us.
Yes, I suppose they should. But we should have thought to ask. Ask who was paying. But I'm sure the old master said that Lord Asriel had left plenty. I'm sure of it.
As if her limbs had been weakened, she stumbled two or three times as she climbed the staircase to her bedroom. She felt bruised and shaken. When she was in bed with Pan curled up on the pillow, she put the light out at once and lay still for a long time before she fell asleep. Chapter 7 Hannah Ralph. Next morning, Lyra felt shy and nervous about going down for breakfast. She slipped into the servants' dining room and helped herself to porridge, not looking around, just smiling and nodding when someone said hello. She felt as if she'd woken up in chains and couldn't free herself, so had to carry them with her wherever she went, like a badge of shame. After breakfast, she drifted through the lodge, not wanting to go back up to the little rooms that had been her home, feeling too heartsick to do what she'd spoken about to Dick and go in search of a vacation job at the mail depot, feeling almost devoid of energy and life. The porter called her, and she turned.
"Letter for you, Lyra," he said. "Do you want to take it now, or pick it up later?"
"I might as well take it now. Thanks."
It was a plain envelope, with her name in a clear, swift hand that she recognized as Dame Hannah Ralph's. A little spring of gratefulness gushed in her breast, for she thought that the lady was a true friend. But then it froze almost at once. Suppose she was going to say that Lyra would have to start paying for her alethiometer lessons. How would she manage that?
"Open it, stupid," said Pan.
"Yes," she said. The card inside said, "Dear Lyra, could you possibly come to see me this afternoon? It's important. Hannah Ralph." Lyra looked at it numbly. "This afternoon? Which afternoon did she mean? Wouldn't she have had to post the letter yesterday? but the date on the card was today's. She looked again at the envelope. She hadn't noticed that there was no stamp, or that the words by hand were written in the top left corner. She turned to the porter, who was putting other letters into a rack of pigeonholes.
"Bill, when did this arrive?"
she said.
"About half an hour ago, by hand."
"Thanks."
She put the letter in her pocket and wandered back through the quad and into the scholar's garden. Most of the trees were bare. The flower bed seemed empty and dead, and only the great cedar looked alive, though it also looked asleep. It was another of those still grey days when silence itself seemed to be a meteorological phenomenon. Not just the result of nothing happening, but a positive presence, larger than gardens and colleges and life. Lyra climbed the stone steps that led up the bank at the end of the garden to a spot overlooking Radcliffe Square and sat on the bench that had been placed there a long time before.
"You know one thing," said Pan.
"What?"
"We can't trust the lock on our door."
"I don't see why not."
"Because we can't trust him."
"Oh, really?"
"Yes, really. We had no clue that he was going to say that last night. He was all smooth and agreeable. He's a hypocrite."
"What did his demon say?"
"Glib, friendly, patronizing stuff. Nothing important at all."
"Well, we haven't got much choice," she said,
finding words hard to come by.
"He needs our rooms. We're not really part of the college. There's no money left. He's got to try and... Oh, I don't know, Pan. It's all just so miserable. And now I'm worried about what Hannah's going to say."
"Well, that's just silly. I know it is.
It doesn't help, though, knowing it."
He stalked to the end of the bench, and then leaped across onto the low wall, beyond which was a 30-foot drop to the cobbles of the square below. She felt a lurch of fear, but nothing would have made her admit it to him. He pretended to stagger and trip and totter on the stone capping, and then, getting no response from Lyra, sank down on his belly into a sphinx posture, paws extended in front, head held high, gazing forward.
"Once we're out," he said. "We won't be able to set foot in the place again. We'll be strangers."
"Yes, I know. I've thought it all through, Pan. So what should we do?"
"When?"
"When it's all over. When we leave."
"Find a job. Find somewhere to live."
"Oh, very easy then. I know it won't be easy." "Actually, I don't know that. Might be very easy, but everyone has to do that. Move away from home, I mean. Go out and make their own life. With most people, their home would always let them come back and welcome them and be glad to hear about what they've been doing."
"Well, good for them. We're different. Always have been. You know that. But what we're not going to do, not for a single second, you hear me, is make a fuss or complain or whine that we're not being treated fairly. It is fair. He's going to let us stay for another year and a bit, even though the money's run out. He's going to pay for St. Sophia's. That's more than fair. The rest is... well, it's up to us, as it would have been anyway. We weren't going to live here forever, were we?"
"I don't see why not. We're an ornament to the college. They should be proud to have us."
That made her smile, anyway, for a moment.
"But maybe you're right about the room, Pan. I mean, locking it."
"Ah.
The alethiometer. That's one of the things I meant. We're not at home anymore. We got to remember that. One of the things. What are the others?"
"The rucksack," Pan said firmly.
"Yes, of course. Suppose someone went in there looking around and found it. They think we'd stolen it. Or worse, they knew about the murder. We need somewhere better than that. A proper safe. Hannah's got one. A safe, I mean."
"Yes, but are we going to tell her?"
He said nothing for a few moments. Then he said,
"Mrs. Lonsdale."
"Alice, yeah, that's another odd thing. All these things that are changing. Like ice breaking under your feet."
"Well, we must have known her name was Alice."
"Yes, but to hear him calling her Alice.
Perhaps they're lovers."
That was too silly to deserve a response. They sat there for a few more minutes, and then Lyra stood up.
"Let's go and make things a bit safer then," she said,
and they set off back to their rooms. When Lyra visited Hannah Ralph, as she did every week during term and quite often during the vacation, she normally took the alethiometer with her, since that was the subject of their study. When she thought of the carefree way she'd carried it with her to the Arctic and out into other worlds, of how she'd thoughtlessly let it be stolen, and how she and Will had stolen it back with such care and at such risk, she was amazed at her own confidence, her own luck. Her stock of those qualities felt low at the moment. So, having made a few changes to the rucksack's hiding place, and having pulled the table over the rug to discourage any search, she made sure the alethiometer was stowed away safely in her bag, along with Hassel's wallet, before she set off to walk to Dame Hannah's little house in Jericho.
"She can't be wanting to give us another lesson," Lyra said. "And we can't be in trouble. At least I hope not."
Although it was still early in the afternoon, Dr. Ralph had lit the lamps in her little sitting room, giving it an air of welcoming cheer against the darkening grey outside. Lyra couldn't even guess how many times she'd sat in this room, with Pan and Hannah's demon Jesper talking quietly on the hearth, while she and Dr. Ralph pored over a dozen or more ancient books and tried the alethiometer again, or simply sat and chatted. She loved this mild and learned lady, she realized, loved everything about her and her way of life.
"Sit down, dear. Stop fretting," Hannah said. "There's no reason to fret. But we do have something to talk about." "It's been worrying me," Lyra said. "I can see. But now tell me about the master, Werner Hammond. I know you had dinner with him last night. What did he say to you?"
Lyra shouldn't have been surprised. The lady's perceptions were so quick and accurate as to seem uncanny, or they would have done if Lyra hadn't known of Hannah's skill with the alethiometer. Nevertheless, this did shake her a little. She gave an account, as full as she could make it, of her dinner with the master. Hannah listened closely, saying nothing till Lyra had finished.
"But he said one thing I forgot till just now," Lyra concluded. "He said he knew you. He'd met you in some diplomatic context. He wasn't specific about it. He just said how clever you were. Do you know him?" "Oh, yes, we've met. I saw enough of him to be very careful." "Why? Is he dishonest or dangerous or something?" "I'm lost, really," Lyra confessed. "I feel as if the floor has given way. I couldn't argue with what he said. It was just such a shock. Anyway, what do you know about him?"
"I'm going to tell you some things I really ought to keep secret. But because I know you so well, and because I trust you to keep things secret if I ask you to, and because you're in some danger... Ah, here's someone I was expecting." She got up as the doorbell rang. Lyra sat back, feeling light-headed and shaky. Voices came from the little hall, and then Dame Hannah came back with...
"Dr. Polstead," said Lyra, "and Mrs. Lonsdale. You too."
"Alice, you goose," said that lady. "Things are changing, Lyra."
"Hello, Lyra," said Dr. Polstead. "Don't move. I'll perch here."
Pan crept behind Lyra's legs as Dr. Polstead sat on the sofa next to Alice, looking too large for the little room. His broad, ruddy face, a farmer's face, she thought, smiling warmly. His red-gold hair, the exact color of his cat demon. His big hands, fingers interlaced as he leaned forward with his elbows on his knees. She felt as if she were catching clumsiness from him, although he had never done anything clumsy. And she recalled the brief period a few years before when he'd been given the task of tutoring her in geography and economic history, and how it had been an embarrassing failure, with each of them clearly resenting this unsuccessful enterprise, but neither wanting to say it. He should have acted sooner to bring it to an end, because he was the adult, after all. But she knew she'd been difficult, and sometimes insolent, and that much of the blame was hers. They just rubbed each other up the wrong way, and there was nothing to be done but call an end to it. Since then, they'd both been scrupulously polite and outwardly friendly, while being relieved to see each other for not a moment more than was necessary. But what Alice had said about him the day before, and now, to see them both on terms of warm friendship with Dame Hannah,
when none of them had ever seemed even to know about the other's existence. Well, these last few days had exposed a lot of strange links and connections. "I didn't know you three knew one another," she said.
"We've been friends for, 19 years, he said.
"It was the alethiometer that told me how to find Malcolm," said Hannah, coming into the room with a tray of tea and biscuits. "He must have been about 11 years old.
"To find him? Were you looking for him, then?"
"I was looking for something that was lost, and it pointed me to Malcolm, who'd found it. We just fell into a sort of friendship."
"I see," said Lyra.
"It was very lucky for me," he said. "Now, what have you said so far?"
Lyra told me what the master said to her last night. He told her that she'd been living not on her father's money, as she'd thought, but on Dr. Kahn's. "Lyra, that is true. The old master didn't want you to know, but he'd paid for everything. Your father didn't leave a penny."
"And did you know that?" said Lyra. "Have you always known that?"
"Yes, I have," said Hannah. "I didn't tell you because he didn't want me to. Besides, you see, I rather kind of hate this," Lyra burst out. "All my life, people have hidden things from me. They didn't tell me that Azrael was my father and Mrs. Coulter was my mother. Imagine finding that out and feeling that everyone in the world knew it and I was the only fool who didn't. Hannah, whatever Dr. Karn said to you, whatever promise you made, it wasn't a good thing to keep it from me. It wasn't. I should have known. It would have woke me up. It would have made me think about the money and ask questions about it and find out that there was only a little left. Then I wouldn't have been so shocked yesterday evening."
She'd never spoken like that to her old friend before, but she knew she was right, and so did Hannah herself, who bowed her head and nodded. Dr. Polstead said, "In Hannah's defense, Lyra, we didn't know what the new master was going to do."
"He shouldn't have done that, though," said Alice. "I never trusted him from the moment he arrived."
"No, he shouldn't," said Hannah. "And in fact, Lyra, Alice was keen to tell you about all this while the old master was still alive. She's not to blame."
"After your 21st birthday," said Dr. Polstead, "when you'll be legally able to manage your own affairs, you would have had to come out. And I know that Hannah was planning to speak to you in time for that. He forestalled us."
"Us?" said Lyra. "And all this? What is all this? I'm sorry, Dr. Polstead, but I don't understand. Are you involved in this somehow? And the other day, what Mrs. Lonsdale, Alice, what she said about you, that took me by surprise too, and for the same reason. You know something about me that I don't, and that's not right. So how are you involved?"
"Well, that's one of the things we're going to tell you this afternoon," he said. "That's why Hannah asked me to come. Shall I start?" he asked, turning to the lady, who nodded. "If I leave out anything important, I know Hannah will remind me."
Lyra leaned back, feeling tense. Pan climbed onto her lap. Alice was watching them both seriously.
"It began around the time Hannah mentioned just now," Dr. Polstead began, "when I found something that was meant for her, and she found me. I was about 11. I was living with my parents at the Trout in Godstow."
The story that unfolded was stranger than Lyra could have guessed. And listening to it felt like standing on a mountain top as a wind blew away clouds of fog and mist and disclosed a panorama completely unsuspected only a few minutes before. There were parts of it that were utterly new and unknown, but also there were other parts that had been visible through the fog in a phantasmagoria and now stood clearly in the sunlight. There was a memory of a night when someone was walking up and down in a moonlit garden, whispering as he held her close, with a great quiet leopard walking alongside. And another memory of a different nighttime garden, with lights in all the trees, and of laughing and laughing for pure happiness, and a little boat, and of a storm, and a thunderous knocking at a door in the darkness. But in Dr. Polstead's account, there was no horse.
"I thought there was a horse," Lyra said.
"No horse," said Alice. "Azrael flew us here in a gyrocopter and landed in Radcliffe Square," Malcolm went on,
and then he put you in the Master's arms and invoked the law of Scholastic Sanctuary. That law had never been repealed.
What's Scholastic Sanctuary? Is it what it sounds like?
It was a law that protected scholars from persecution.
But I wasn't a scholar.
Oddly enough, that was just what the Master said. So your father said, you'll have to make her into one then, won't you? And then he left.
Lyra sat back, a heart full, a mind whirling. So much to understand. She hardly knew what to ask about first.
Hannah, who had been listening quietly, leaned forward to put another log on the fire. Then she got up to draw the curtains against the darkness outside.
Well, said Lyra, I suppose... Well, thank you. I don't mean to sound ungracious or anything. Thank you for saving me from the flood and everything. This is all so strange. And the alethiometer. This one.
She reached into the rucksack and tugged it out, unfolding the black velvet to let it rest on her knee. It glowed in the lamplight.
The man Bonneville, the one with the hyena demon who was chasing you, had it, she said. So much to take in. Where did he get it from?
We found out much later, said Hannah. He stole it from a monastery in Bohemia.
Well, then, shouldn't it go back there?
Lyra said.
But her heart sank at the thought of losing this most precious thing, this instrument that had helped her find her way into and out of the world of the dead, that had told her the truth about Will. He is a murderer, in the only way that would have let her trust him, that had saved their lives and restored the Bear King's armor and done 100 other extraordinary things. Her hands involuntarily tightened around it.
No, said Hannah.
The monks had stolen it themselves from a traveller who made the mistake of taking shelter with them. I took a month once to investigate the provenance of your alethiometer, and it seems to have passed from one set of thieves to another for centuries. When Malcolm pushed it among your blankets, it was the first time it had changed hands honestly for hundreds of years. And I think that broke the pattern.
It was stolen from me once, said Lyra, and we had to steal it back.
It's yours, and unless you choose to give it away, it'll be yours for life, said Dr. Polstead.
And all those other things you told me. That fairy. Did you really mean a fairy? Or was it that you imagined... It can't have been true.
It was, said Alice. She was called Diania. She put you to the breast and suckled you. You've drunk fairy milk, and you'd be with her still if Malcolm hadn't fooled her and got us away.
Flood brought a lot of strange things to light, said Malcolm.
But why didn't you tell me before?
He looked a little abashed.
How mobile his face was, Lyra thought. He looked like a stranger. It was as if she'd never seen him before.
We, Alice and I, always said to each other that we would, he said, but the time never seemed to be right. Besides... Dr. Carne made us both promise never to talk to you about Bonneville or anything connected with him. It was part of the sanctuary business. We didn't understand then, but we did later. It was to protect you. But things are changing fast. Now I'll hand over to Hannah.
When I first met Malcolm, the lady said, I did something rather reckless. It turned out that he was very well placed to pick up the kind of information I was interested in. And I encouraged him to do that. He sometimes overheard things in his parents' pub or elsewhere that were worth noting. He took messages for me, or collected them from other places. He was able to tell me about an abominable organization called the League of St. Alexander, which recruited schoolchildren to inform on their parents to the magisterium.
It sounds like, Lyra said, I don't know, a spy story or something.
It's not very easy to believe.
I suppose it does.
The point was that a lot of the political arguments and struggles that were going on then had to be carried out surreptitiously, anonymously. It was a dangerous time.
Was that what you were doing? Political things?
That sort of thing. It didn't stop. It hasn't stopped. In some ways, things are even more difficult now. For example, there's a bill before Parliament at the moment called the Rectification of Historical Anomalies Bill. It's portrayed as a simple tidying-up measure, to do away with a lot of old statutes that don't make sense anymore, or are irrelevant to modern life, such as benefit of clergy, or the right of certain livery companies to catch and eat herons and swans, or the gathering of tithes by monastic bodies that are long gone, ancient privileges that no one's used for years. But, tucked away among the obsolete provisions to be abolished, is the right of scholastic sanctuary, which is what still protects you.
Protects me from what?
Lyra found that her voice was shaky. From the magisterium.
But why would they want to hurt me?
We don't know.
But why hasn't anyone in Parliament noticed this? Isn't anyone arguing against it?
It's a very complicated and long-winded piece of legislation. My sources tell me that it was introduced on the urging of a new organization gaining power in Geneva, La Maison Juste. More to them than you'd think at first, but they're connected to the CCD, I believe. Anyway, it was cleverly done. You need the eyes of an eagle and the patience of a snail to fight something like that. There was an MP called Bernard Crombie leading the fight against it, but he was killed recently, supposedly in a road accident.
I read about it, said Lyra. It was here in Oxford. He was knocked down and the driver didn't stop.
You don't mean he was murdered?
I'm afraid so, said Dr. Polstead. We know what happened, but we can't prove it in court. Point is that the protection that's been around you since Lord Asriel put you in the Master's arms is now slowly and deliberately being dismantled.
And what the new Master said to you last night, said Hannah, just confirms it.
So he, Dr. Hammond, he's on the other side, whatever that is.
He's no scholar, said Alice decisively. He's only a businessman.
Yes, said Dr. Polstead.
His background is relevant. We're not sure yet how it all connects, but if that law's passed, it'll give business corporations the chance to help themselves to a good deal of property, for example, whose ownership was never clearly established. If there's any dispute, it'll be resolved in favour of money and power. Even the ruins of Godstow Priory will be up for sale.
There were men there just the other day measuring things, said Alice. The changes Dr. Hammond told you about last night are part of a bigger pattern, said Hannah. It makes you even more vulnerable.
Lyra couldn't speak. She held Pantelimon close and looked into the fire.
But he did say...
She began very quietly, and then spoke up. He did say the college would pay for the rest of my education, my time at St. Sophia's. So what does he want? Does he want me to finish and get my degree, or what? I just don't understand. I can't take this in.
I'm afraid there's more, said Hannah.
The money that was left you by Dr. Kahn, the money Hammond said was all used up, Malcolm can tell you about that.
In his old age, Dr. Kahn was easily confused, said Dr. Polstead, and money and figures weren't his strong point in any case. What seems to have happened is that he did put a considerable sum aside. We don't know how much, but there would have been plenty left still, only he was persuaded to invest it in a fund that crashed. It simply failed, very badly managed or deliberately ruined. The money wasn't in the hands of the college solicitor, no matter what Dr. Hammond told you. In fact, the solicitor tried hard to prevent the old master from investing in that fund. But, of course, he had to do what his client wanted. You might know the college solicitor. A very tall man. Quite old now. His demon is a kestrel.
Oh, yes. Lyra remembered him. She had never known exactly who he was, but he had always been kind and courteous to her, and genuinely interested in her progress.
They timed it well. Alice put in. It wasn't long before the old master began to lose his way, poor old boy. Forgetting things.
I remember, Lyra said. It was so sad. Oh, I loved him.
Many people did, said Hannah. But once he'd become unable to manage his affairs, the solicitor had to take power of attorney. If Dr. Kahn had wanted to invest the money in the bad fund at that stage, it could have been prevented.
Just a minute. Lyra said. Alice said they timed it well.
You don't mean it was intentional. You don't mean they, the other side, they lost his money on purpose.
It looks very like it, said Dr. Polstead.
But why?
To damage you. You wouldn't even have been aware of it till... well, till now.
They were... while the old master was still alive, they were deliberately trying to hurt...
Yes. We've only just found that out. And it was the thing that prompted us to call you here and tell you about this. Now she really couldn't speak. It was Pantalaimon who spoke for her.
But why?
He said.
We have no idea, said Hannah. For some reason, the other side needs you vulnerable. And for the sake of everything good and valuable, we need you safe. But you're not the only one. There are other scholars protected by Scholastic Sanctuary.